directly, one told a McNamara aide, "We'll be lucky to get the order to the fleet in time for the evening news." McNamara continued to develop options for a retaliatory strike. He described the first four as both sharp and limited. The fifth was designed to place continuing pressure on North Vietnam. The five options were 1. Airstrikes against PT boats and their bases. 2. Airstrikes against petroleum installations. 3. Airstrikes on bridges. 4. Airstrikes on prestige targets, such as a steel plant. 5. The option for continuing pressure against the North Vietnamese is to mine important ports along the coastline. The president and his advisors had already planned to meet for the regular Tuesday luncheon, and McNamara wanted to have the options ready for the president before then. McNamara met with Rusk, McGeorge Bundy, Vance, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, without General Wheeler, in the Defense Secretary's dining room. McNamara queried the chiefs for specific information with which he could develop his own options for retaliation. Bundy and McNamara weighed the relative advantages and disadvantages of either retaliating with a sharp, limited blow or mining the North Vietnamese coast to place continuing pressure on the Hanoi government. At the close of the meeting, McNamara charged the JCS with nominating targets for an immediate reprisal and recommending additional actions for 24, 48, and 60 hours ahead. Leaving the JCS to complete these tasks, McNamara retired to his office with Vance, Bundy, Rusk, and Marshall Green, assistant to William Bundy. In the absence of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they quickly narrowed the retaliatory options to 3. 1. Sharp limited attacks against such target as PT boats, PT bases, oil depots, etc. 2. Continued pressure, i.e., mining the Vietnam coast. 3. A combination of both. The five men then left the Pentagon for the White House. When they arrived, the president was at an NSC meeting. Johnson did not want the Gulf of Tonkin incident discussed in any detail outside the small circle of his closest advisors. He spoke of the incident only briefly at the NSC meeting, explaining that Secretary McNamara and I are preparing recommendations, but these are not yet ready. He warned that he wanted nothing made public for the time being. Soon after McNamara arrived at the White House, the JCS, concerned that McNamara know which option they preferred before he met with the president, told General Birkenall to inform him of their recommendation. Although the chiefs endorsed the general idea of a sharp limited response option, they recommended a heavy effort to establish an outer parameter of how far the United States was willing to go should North Vietnam continue to undertake actions hostile to the United States. After the NSC meeting adjourned, McNamara, Rusk, Bundy, Vance, and Director of Central Intelligence John McCone joined the president for lunch. They determined that the American planned and supported raids on North Vietnamese territory provided the only rational explanation for the second attack. They concluded, however, that the covert forays above the 17th parallel did not justify attacks on American destroyers in international waters. McNamara laid out maps with possible targets highlighted. Much of the discussion, which lasted for nearly 2 hours, focused on the political ramifications of retaliation. The president and his advisors pondered retaliatory options in light of likely reactions from Barry Goldwater, Congress, the press, and foreign governments. Johnson agreed with McNamara's recommendation that the reprisal be both sharp and limited, and rejected the Joint Chiefs' advice that the airstrikes establish an outer parameter of how far the United States was willing to go. Rusk argued forcefully that the president limit the strikes to patrol boat bases and the Vinh oil refinery and not attack Hanoi, Haiphong, or more general targets. He convinced Johnson that the United States must leave to the other side responsibility for escalation. The president ordered retaliatory strikes against PT boats located at 5 North Vietnamese ports and the oil depot at Vinh. McNamara told Johnson that he would work the strikes out carefully with the JCS upon his return to the Pentagon. The president remained anxious for the American planes to strike their targets within the next 4 hours, in time for the 7 o'clock news. McNamara then met with the chiefs to inform them of the president's decision. The JCS began to draft the order to initiate the strike. As the chiefs went to work on the order, however, a re-evaluation of the events in the Gulf of Tonkin reached the Pentagon. Captain John Herrick, commander of the destroyer task force, reported that review of action makes many reported contacts and torpedoes fired appear doubtful. Freak weather effects on radar and overeager sonar men may have accounted for many reports. No actual visual sightings by Maddox suggest complete evaluation before any further action taken. McNamara, well on the way to launching the operation against North Vietnam, called Admiral Sharp and asked, "There isn't any possibility that there was no attack, is there?" Sharp replied, "Yes, I would say there is a slight possibility." McNamara asked, "How do we reconcile all this?" Sharp said that he was trying to get further information and recommended that he hold the attack order until we have a definite indication that this happened. McNamara told Sharp to leave the order in effect and instructed the admiral to call him with an update before 6 o'clock. At 4:47, McNamara again met with the JCS to marshal the evidence to overcome the lack of a clear and convincing showing that an attack on the destroyer had in fact occurred. In response to Sharp's request for confirmation, Captain Herrick cabled that he was certain that the original ambush was bona fide. He stated that sailors had made sightings of cockpit lights and that the Turner Joy had reported that two torpedoes passed nearby. The JCS and McNamara considered Herrick's report, communication intelligence radio intercepts that the North Vietnamese had shot at two American aircraft and sacrificed two of their boats, and Admiral Sharp's personal determination that an attack had indeed occurred as conclusive evidence. Sharp, however, recalled having indicated to McNamara only that the weight of evidence supported the conclusion that an attack had occurred. The JCS retransmitted the strike order to SINCPAC at 5:19. General Wheeler, who had returned to Washington in time for the meeting, accompanied Secretary McNamara to the White House for pro forma consultations with the NSC and congressional leaders. The NSC meeting convened at 6:15 and lasted less than half an hour. McNamara began by stating that the North Vietnamese patrol boats have continued their attacks on the two U.S. destroyers in international waters in the Gulf of Tonkin. He mentioned that our efforts to learn the exact situation and protect the patrol have been complicated by a very low ceiling. McCone predicted that the proposed U.S. reprisals will result in a sharp North Vietnamese reaction, but such action would not represent a deliberate decision to provoke or accept a major escalation in the Vietnamese War. He told Johnson and the NSC that the North Vietnamese were reacting defensively to our attacks on their offshore islands and had responded out of pride and on the basis of defense considerations. The meeting was aimed and ensuring that everyone was on board with the president's decision to retaliate, for the Joint Chiefs of Staff had already issued the strike order. Johnson asked a rhetorical question. Are we going to react to their shooting at our ships over 40 miles from their shores? He told his staff and cabinet officials that as far as he was concerned, the only issue was the numbers of North Vietnamese targets to be attacked. The meeting with congressional leaders began moments after the NSC meeting ended. The departure of cabinet officials and White House staffers no doubt gave the congressman the impression that the president had just completed wide-ranging deliberations. Johnson began by warning that some of our boys are floating around in the water and asked that they keep the information about to be revealed in closest confidence. The congressman learned of the alleged incident and of the president's plan to retaliate. Rusk articulated the reasoning behind the limited nature of the reprisal. He argued that while the United States must make it clear that we are not going to run out on Southeast Asia, it must also convey to North Vietnam that its objectives were narrowly defined. Rusk hoped further that the reprisal would not only put an end to attacks on American vessels, but also help coerce North Vietnam into desisting from its support for the insurgency in the South. He told Senator Bork B. Hickenlooper, the ranking Republican on the Foreign Relations Committee, that we are trying to get across two points. One, leave your neighbors alone. And two, if you don't, we will have to get busy. Neither McNamara nor anyone else mentioned the uncertainty surrounding the actuality of the attack or the provocative role that 34 Alpha operations played in precipitating the reported North Vietnamese action. Although General Wheeler and the Joint Chiefs of Staff had been on the fringes of the President's deliberations about the reprisal against North Vietnam, and their proposal for a heavy effort had been rejected, Johnson used the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to lend uniformed credibility to his decisions. He announced that the Joint Chiefs have gone over it all. General Wheeler is here. I would like him to report on the recommendations of General Taylor in Vietnam. Although Taylor had pressed for action after the first Gulf of Tonkin incident, he played no significant role in the development of plans for the second reported attack. The president had selected an option developed and presented by McNamara, based primarily on how retaliatory action would affect his popularity with American voters. Wheeler was to cast the president's recommendations in the light of military expertise and thereby increase their appeal to legislators generally sympathetic to the military point of view. Wheeler did not mention that he had already sent the recommended course of action to the Pacific Fleet in the form of an order, and he presented McNamara's plan for reprisal as a JCS proposal. After Wheeler summarized the plan, Johnson told the legislators that he wanted the advice of each of you and wanted to consult with you. We felt we should move with action recommended by the Joint Chiefs, but I wanted to get congressional concurrence. When the ambassador's views were more consistent with the president's than the Joint Chiefs, Johnson used them as a professional military endorsement of his decisions. Indeed, it is significant that Johnson asked the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, rather than the Secretary of State, to report on the recommendations of an ambassador. The president also called his diplomatic representative in Saigon, General Taylor, underlining the degree to which he considered the ambassador a military advisor. Taylor was more willing than the Joint Chiefs to accept substantial restrictions on the application of military power. Although Wheeler did not deliberately distort the chief's view, as Taylor had done previously, he remained silent when the president misrepresented military advice. After the president read the statement he intended to make to the American people, several of the legislators asked Johnson why he was describing the retaliation as limited. Republican Senator Leverett Saltonstall of Massachusetts commented that three times in that little statement he used the word limited. Why not use the word determined and let the limitations speak for themselves? Senate Republican leader Everett Dirksen suggested that the president put the word limited in deep freeze. The president replied that he wanted to communicate to North Vietnam that we're not going to take it lying down, but we're not going to destroy their cities. Johnson stated clearly that this retaliation would be precedent-setting and provide a model for future action. The president hoped that the airstrikes against North Vietnam, which would begin in the next several hours, would prepare them for the course we will follow. At the conclusion of the meeting, Johnson told the congressman that he would soon ask them for a resolution to validate the use of force in Vietnam. The president concluded, "I have told you what I want from you." He then went around the table, asking for the views and receiving the support of each member of Congress. House Republican leader Charles A. Halleck assured the president that his resolution would pass overwhelmingly. Johnson returned to the Oval Office to prepare for his appearance on national television. When General Wheeler and McNamara returned to the Pentagon, they found that the attack had been delayed. Air crews were working vigorously to reconfigure armaments on the Navy jets, and the aircraft carrier Constellation was making its way toward the Gulf of Tonkin at best speed to join in the attack. It began to look as if the president's announcement, which had already missed the 7 o'clock news, might be delayed until after the 11 o'clock program, which would also mean missing the final deadline for the major East Coast papers. The president grew more impatient with each passing minute. He telephoned McNamara at frequent intervals, demanding to know precisely when he could go on the air. By 11 o'clock, the president could no longer suppress his anger. He shouted into the phone, "Bob, I'm exposed here. I've got to make my speech right now." At 11:36 p.m., President Johnson, appearing somber and determined, sat behind his desk in the Oval Office and looked into the television camera. His statement placed the Tonkin Gulf incident in larger context of the struggle for peace and security in Southeast Asia. He told Americans that aggression by terror against the peaceful villagers of South Vietnam has now been joined by open aggression on the high seas against the United States of America. Johnson described the retaliatory strikes as limited and fitting, and assured his audience that we still seek no wider war. The president told Americans that his decision to order military action had been solemn, but observed that firmness in the right is indispensable today for peace. In closing, the president promised the people that, under his stewardship, firmness will always be measured. 1 hour and 30 minutes after the president announced the attack, the first planes reached their targets. Naval pilots flew 64 sorties against North Vietnamese naval vessels and the oil storage facility at Vinh. They reported hitting 33 of 34 boats and the near-complete destruction of the oil depot. Two American planes were shot down. Lieutenant Richard C. Sather was the first naval aviator killed in action over Southeast Asia. Lieutenant Everett Alvarez Jr. ejected from his shattered aircraft and was captured near the North Vietnamese port of Hangay. In extreme pain from a fractured back, Alvarez was moved by his captors to a prison camp in Hanoi, where he was subjected to severe physical and mental abuse for 8.5 years. After all was quiet in the Gulf of Tonkin, officials in the Johnson administration scrambled to push the president's resolution through Congress. George Ball had been hard at work finalizing the already drafted congressional resolution. The final version stated that Congress approves and supports the determination of the president as commander-in-chief to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. The resolution went on to describe American interests in Vietnam as vital and pledged that the United States was prepared to take all necessary steps, including the use of armed force, to defend the freedom of its allies in Southeast Asia. Rusk coordinated the text with congressional leaders. Ball then began to meet privately with key members of Congress to solicit their support for the resolution. On August 6th, General Wheeler accompanied McNamara and Rusk to a joint session of the Senate Foreign Relations and Armed Services Committees. The three men sat shoulder to shoulder in front of a massive oval table. Rusk and McNamara read prepared statements, and then the senators began to ask questions. The session was amicable until Oregon's Democratic Senator, Wayne Morse, interviewed the three men. He had received a tip from a Pentagon official that the Maddox had not been on routine patrol, but had been gathering intelligence for 34 Alpha operations when the incident occurred. The official had also intimated that there was a hell of a lot of confusion surrounding the August 4th attack on the Maddox and Turner Joy. As a result, Morse was the only senator to ask tough questions. Addressing Morse's concerns that 34 Alpha operations might have provoked the North Vietnamese response, McNamara assured the senators that the U.S. Navy played absolutely no part in was not associated with and was not aware of any South Vietnamese actions, if there were any. I want to make that very clear. McNamara went on to state that the Maddox was not informed of, was not aware, had no evidence of, and so far as I know today, had no knowledge of any possible South Vietnamese actions. Later in the hearing, McNamara acknowledged that some shelling of North Vietnamese islands had occurred, but again denied U.S. knowledge of the actions. He also misrepresented the 34 Alpha raids as an effort to patrol the Vietnamese coast to interdict infiltration into South Vietnam. He described the boat operations as, in a sense, pickets or patrols stationed in particular areas carrying out routine surveillance. After an hour and 40 minutes, McNamara, Wheeler, and Rusk completed the Senate hearing and walked to the opposite side of the Capitol to testify before the House Armed Services and Foreign Affairs Committees. The second hearing lasted considerably less than an hour. The resolution passed the Senate and House committees without difficulty. McNamara had done well for the president. Morse's questions about the role of 34 Alpha operations and the verity of the second attack attracted little attention. The defense secretary successfully misled the senators and representatives by misrepresenting America's role in the 34 Alpha attacks and by glossing over the confusion surrounding the August 4th incident. At 5 o'clock in the afternoon, McNamara held a press conference in the Pentagon. When asked whether he knew of any incidents involving South Vietnamese vessels and North Vietnam, he replied, "No, none that I know of. They operate on their own. They are part of the South Vietnamese Navy, operating in the coastal waters, inspecting suspicious incoming junks, seeking to deter and prevent the infiltration of both men and material." A reporter pressed him, "Do these junks go north into North Vietnamese waters?" McNamara responded, "They have advanced closer and closer to the 17th parallel, and in some cases, I think, have moved beyond that in an effort to stop the infiltration closer to the point of origin." It was a fitting end to a day of cunning responses to questions from reporters and legislators. McNamara dominated the responses to congressional questions during the August 6 hearings. Wheeler answered several technical questions, but McNamara responded quickly to those questions that were not directed toward a specific person. Although Wheeler did not make any false statements to the senators or congressmen, by not revealing the truth, he showed the president that he would go along with his and McNamara's attempts to mislead Congress and the American people. Military officers were not in the habit of challenging publicly and directly statements from their civilian bosses. Wheeler may have felt that expediency as well as loyalty justified his silence while the defense secretary avoided or misrepresented the truth. The general, who had warned Westmoreland that the war in Vietnam could be lost in Congress, was reluctant to give the legislators information that could undermine the administration's commitment to South Vietnam. Sitting silently next to McNamara, Wheeler, dressed in his uniform, the light from the Capitol's crystal chandeliers reflecting off his brass insignia, lent indispensable credibility to his defense secretary's remarks. Congressional faith in the integrity of the military was based in part on the expectation that JCS views and recommendations were independent of partisan political concerns and based solely on officers' experience and evaluation of the military aspects of the situation. Johnson and his advisors predicated the Gulf of Tonkin reprisal, however, on domestic political concerns and their election year campaign strategy, hiding the true basis of their decisions behind the impression that they were simply supporting recommendations made by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Wheeler's attendance at McNamara's side and his tacit support of the Defense Secretary's effort to obscure the nature of American military policy in Vietnam served as Wheeler's trial by fire. Although his influence as a military advisor was low, Wheeler had become a valuable shield to protect the administration from attacks on its decisions regarding Vietnam. Although the second attack was not deliberately faked, domestic political considerations connected with the election impelled Johnson and McNamara to seize on uncertain circumstances as sufficient provocation for a retaliatory strike. Indeed, it soon became apparent that the retaliation against North Vietnam after the Gulf of Tonkin incidents was a political coup for the president. He received a surge of support in the polls. The decision to strike North Vietnam and the overwhelming passage of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution defused Goldwater's charges that LBJ had not been firm enough in matters of foreign policy. William Bundy recalled that, after the airstrikes on North Vietnam, a feeling of satisfaction pervaded the administration. On August 10th, Johnson met in the cabinet room with Wheeler, McNamara, Rusk, Vance, Ball, McCone, and McGeorge Bundy. He recognized the instrumental role of the Secretaries of State and Defense in securing such favorable responses from Congress and, judging from the polls, from the American people. Although Johnson did not mention him, General Wheeler deserved much of the credit for gathering support for the resolution by adding credibility to McNamara's and Rusk's testimony. Chapter 7, Contriving Consensus, August to September, 1964. There have been no divisions in this government. We may have been wrong, but we have not been divided. Lyndon B. Johnson, 1967. The period of self-congratulation after the airstrikes was short-lived. The taking of direct American action against North Vietnam forced the president and his advisors to ponder their next moves. In Saigon, the Gulf of Tonkin reprisals raised hopes among some of the people that the retaliatory raids were the beginning of a sustained campaign against their adversaries north of the 17th parallel, and that direct U.S. involvement would resolve their 10-year struggle with Hanoi and the Viet Cong. In less than 1 week, however, it was apparent to all that the United States would not undertake a sustained military campaign. Rising expectations among the South Vietnamese gave way to dashed hopes and heightened discontent. Although President Johnson took care to characterize the attack on North Vietnam as limited and fitting, and had assured the American electorate that his administration sought no wider war, others within the administration, most notably the Joint Chiefs of Staff and Ambassador Taylor, wanted to keep the pressure on the Hanoi government. The JCS and Taylor regarded August 4 as a turning point in U.S. policy on direct action against North Vietnam, although they disagreed about both the form and the intensity of the operations following the reprisals. The American response to the Gulf of Tonkin incident had used up many of McNamara's plans for Vietnam, leading Lyndon Johnson and his advisors to consider future actions. In May, McNamara, McGeorge Bundy, and Rusk recommended that the president agree in principle to use selected and carefully graduated military force against North Vietnam. The May memo called for a congressional resolution approving that plan and an initial strike against the North to have more deterrent than destructive impact. Based on the belief that a pound of threat is worth an ounce of action, they asked the president to approve the deployment of American forces towards Southeast Asia to maximize their deterrent impact and their menace. By mid-August, he had acted on most of their recommendations. The initial strike occurred on August 4. The president got his congressional resolution on August 10. And on August 5, Secretary McNamara announced that the following military deployments were underway. Transfer of an attack carrier group from the Pacific Coast to the Western Pacific. Movement of interceptor and fighter-bomber aircraft into South Vietnam. Movement of fighter-bomber aircraft into Thailand. transfer of interceptor and fighter bomber squadrons from the United States to advance bases in the Pacific, movement of an anti-submarine force into the South China Sea, the alerting and readying for movement of selected Army and Marine forces. It was unclear when Johnson would approve additional actions in support of the central recommendation of the May Memorandum, the gradual application of additional military pressures on North Vietnam. Deliberations about Vietnam, conducted in the middle of a presidential campaign, solidified two critical assumptions. First, that the principal difficulty in South Vietnam stemmed from North Vietnam's support for the Viet Cong. And second, that the gradual application of military and diplomatic pressures on the Hanoi government would persuade North Vietnam's leaders to terminate that support. The period surrounding the 1964 presidential election also marked a subtle but significant shift in the nature of the advisory relationship between the Joint Chiefs of Staff and top policymakers in the Johnson administration. The chiefs, still unable to reconcile their own differences, dropped their fundamental objections to McNamara's conception of the war, focusing instead on removing limits to the level of force and restrictions on its use. Taylor joined his former colleagues in urging direct American military action against North Vietnam. Taylor's perspective on Vietnam had changed with his assignment as ambassador. Now exposed daily to the frustrations of organizing a counterinsurgency effort against an elusive and determined enemy, he began to view with sympathy the South Vietnamese government's call for action against the North. General Khan, who had come to believe that communists in South Vietnam were no less than the arms of the enemy monster, and that the monster's head was in Hanoi, argued for the decapitation of his enemy. He wanted the United States and South Vietnam to open the war up with a decisive campaign to secure the objective of total victory in order to liberate all the national territory. Washington, however, was not going to let Saigon dictate the scope and tempo of the war. Taylor's sympathy with Khan's frustration put the ambassador at odds with Rusk and others in Washington. Although Taylor did not share Khan's enthusiasm for immediate airstrikes against the North, he advocated other military measures, such as the continuation of covert maritime strikes against North Vietnam and naval and air patrols in the Gulf of Tonkin to keep pressure on North Vietnam and signal American resolve. He suggested more permissive rules of engagement, allowing air and sea patrols to fire on enemy boats and aircraft. He warned that if the United States resisted mounting pressures from the South Vietnamese government to win the war by direct attack on Hanoi, the South Vietnamese might pursue a negotiated settlement or an independent military adventure against North Vietnam. To placate the Saigon government, Taylor recommended that the United States apply limited pressure on the North immediately and prepare to implement a bombing campaign after January 1, 1965. Johnson, however, remained reluctant to take any action that might bring Vietnam once again to the forefront of public attention. The Democratic National Convention would begin on August 24th, and the election campaign, combined with his domestic legislative agenda, dominated the president's attention. On August 10th, less than an hour after he signed into law the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, the president charged his advisors with developing a plan of action for Vietnam that would allow the United States to retain the initiative gained during the Gulf of Tonkin reprisals, with maximum results and minimum danger. McGeorge Bundy whispered to Ray Klein, Deputy Director for Intelligence at the CIA, "We know we're not going to do a goddamn thing while this goddamn election is going on." Rusk instructed Taylor to keep General Khan as far as possible on the same track as ourselves regarding possible action against the North. The task of developing a Vietnam policy that would minimize dangers to the president's prospects for election fell to the man Johnson called that other Bundy. William Putnam Bundy had impeccable academic, professional, and social credentials. After receiving his law degree from Harvard in 1947, he entered the prestigious Washington law firm of Covington and Burling. 3 years later, he joined the CIA as an intelligence analyst. Bundy was Dean Acheson's son-in-law and, like his brother, was well-connected within the Democratic establishment. Many thought that he would eventually rise to be Director of Central Intelligence. In 1961, however, Bundy moved to the Defense Department as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, or ISA. When the head of ISA, Paul Nitze, became Secretary of the Navy, Bundy succeeded him. Bundy liked working with McNamara, and in 1964, when he was named to replace Roger Hilsman as Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs, he reluctantly left the Defense Department. It was from his desk in the State Department, however, that Bundy left his imprint on the American experience in Vietnam. He undertook to reconcile calls for further action against North Vietnam with the president's mandate that these actions present minimum danger. McNamara recalled that the memorandum Bundy completed in mid-August 1964 set the agenda for policy deliberation and became the focus of our attention until January 1965. Despite his limited experience in the planning and application of military force, Bundy had confidence in his analytical ability. He found it unnecessary to consult the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but coordinated his effort closely with McNamara and Rusk. Bundy's charge was to get the administration through the election with a possible set of actions that would help morale in South Vietnam, put some pressure on North Vietnam, and yet present minimum risks of the war becoming more serious. The JCS, meanwhile, tried to answer the questions that Johnson posed to General Wheeler during the August 10th meeting. Wheeler and his colleagues focused on the following items. 1. What, if any, action should be taken in the Laos Panhandle? 2. Should the tempo of Operations Plan 34 Alpha operations be increased? 3. Should we initiate a tit-for-tat program of retaliation, or should we do something more against North Vietnam? If so, what and when? Still encumbered by the need to forge consensus, the chiefs, before submitting a response, were unable to complete this major exercise by the time Bundy circulated his draft policy paper. The senior military advisors, rather than examining the issue on their own terms, found themselves in the familiar position of responding to a paper that carried the weight of an agreed position between the Secretaries of Defense and State. Bundy called for a short holding phase of 10 days to 2 weeks, during which the United States would avoid any actions that might divert international attention from North Vietnam's provocation in the Gulf of Tonkin. After this period of military silence, American and South Vietnamese forces would undertake a program of limited pressures against the North Vietnamese government from September through December 1964. These pressures might include an intensification and overt acknowledgement of 34 Alpha operations, leaked information revealing joint U.S.-South Vietnamese planning for cross-border operations against North Vietnam and into Cambodia and Laos, intensified training of South Vietnamese pilots on jet aircraft, limited cross-border operations into Laos, the resumption of naval patrols in the Gulf of Tonkin, tit-for-tat retaliations for Viet Cong dirty tricks, and the withdrawal of American dependents. Bundy recommended that the sequence be played somewhat by ear with the aim of producing a slightly increased tempo, but one that does not commit us prematurely to even stronger actions. Although Bundy acknowledged that his scheme did not comprise a truly coherent program of strong enough pressure, he expressed hope that the pretty high noise level might threaten North Vietnam with the possibility of systematic military action in the future. He recommended that the administration adopt General Taylor's contingency date of January 1, 1965 for direct American military action against North Vietnam. Although reluctant to accept the implicit objective behind Bundy's limited pressures against the North, the JCS offered no alternative plan. Bundy's program aimed to send a signal of resolve to the communists and boost the morale of the South Vietnamese while minimizing the possibility of escalation before the November election. The chiefs restated the position they had espoused consistently since January 22, 1964. Military action against North Vietnam should instead aim to destroy the Hanoi government's will and capability to continue support for the insurgency in South Vietnam. Caught without their own program for military action against North Vietnam, however, the chiefs chose neither to challenge Bundy's concept of limited actions nor to question the wisdom of pursuing the short-term objective of holding on in South Vietnam until the new year. They argued against the holding strategy only with the ambiguous observation that the sudden advantage gained in the wake of the Gulf of Tonkin incident must be retained through the application of more serious pressures against North Vietnam as necessary. On August 14th, the chiefs informed McNamara that they would develop more detailed recommendations on military action as rapidly as possible. Sharp disagreements among the chiefs over the nature of the problem in Vietnam and the type of military action necessary to improve the situation delayed the drafting of any response until August 26th. Army Chief of Staff Johnson recalled that although there was general agreement among the chiefs that the situation in Vietnam required some action, the services possessed a wide variety of views on what those actions should entail. Differences of opinion among the chiefs stemmed, in part, from their institutional perspectives as heads of their services. It seemed that each of the services, rather than attempt to determine the true nature of the war and source of the insurgency in South Vietnam, assumed that it alone had the capacity to win the war. The Air Force believed that bombing North Vietnam and interdicting infiltration routes could solve the problem of the insurgency in the South. Trained in the fluid application of destructive force, Air Force planners gave little thought to the more complex difficulties of pacifying the countryside and establishing South Vietnamese governmental control and security on the ground. The Army, whose mission would entail the introduction of ground troops, thought that the problem in South Vietnam was only partially connected with North Vietnam's support for the insurgency. It planned to pacify the countryside by means of political action and military security. The Army viewed increased American involvement in Vietnam in the context of a protracted commitment of ground forces and believed that bombing the North might intensify the war in the South. Since February, General LeMay had pressed for the use of American air power against North Vietnam, arguing that the Gulf of Tonkin retaliation should serve as a starting point for sustained airstrikes which would destroy all 94 targets on the JCS list. On August 17th, LeMay sent General Wheeler a study conducted by the RAND Corporation, whose thesis was that the total commitment of Hanoi to the success of the insurgency is the key to the strength of the Viet Cong. The study argued that Hanoi provided the Viet Cong with leadership, a sophisticated political military apparatus, a compelling ideological theme, and a secure military base. LeMay tried to use the study to persuade his colleagues on the Joint Chiefs that action against the North was necessary to defeat the insurgency in the South. Air power, he contended, offered the best chance of success and could win the war without the introduction of Army troops or Marines into South Vietnam. LeMay persuaded General Greene, Commandant of the Marine Corps, to join him in urging action against the North. Greene, however, continued to advocate bombing as only the first step in a larger program that included the introduction of large numbers of Marines into South Vietnam to establish secure enclaves along the coast. The Marine Corps had been planning such a deployment of ground forces to the South Vietnamese coastal city of Da Nang since the Gulf of Tonkin incident. In August, a Marine Brigade commander conducted a reconnaissance of the port facility and the terrain surrounding the city. Marine units established communications and combat outposts some 30 miles inland from the coast, just south of the demilitarized zone. While Green was aggressively seeking a wider role in the war for the Marine Corps, the Army Chief of Staff disapproved of a wider American role in the war. Harold Johnson viewed his JCS colleagues with suspicion. He harbored deep reservations concerning Air Force and Marine Corps views on how to wage the war. He felt that the Marine Corps, head-down-in-charge mentality, often led to ill-considered actions and excessive casualties. He thought that the Marine Corps should be kept lean and mean and fairly small, and its mission limited to seizing advanced naval bases. Johnson's experience during the Korean War and his work on a committee charged with delineating the roles and missions of each service made him resentful of claims concerning the capabilities of air power. Although he was predisposed to conflict with his colleagues, Johnson proved more acquiescent with his civilian bosses. A survivor of the Bataan Death March in World War II, Johnson had endured 3.5 years in a Japanese prison camp, and when rescued at war's end, weighed just 90 pounds. That harrowing experience had rekindled in him the deep religious faith of his rural South Dakota boyhood. Spiritual fortitude and a profound sense of loyalty led him to accept conditions outside his direct personal control and to work as best he could within the constraints of a difficult situation, rather than confront directly the source of adversity. He therefore did not object to, but reluctantly accepted, wider American involvement in South Vietnam. Indeed, none of the chiefs individually objected to William Bundy's policy of holding South Vietnam by applying limited pressure on the North. The JCS still had not agreed on its position by August 18th, when Ambassador Taylor sent his assessment of the Bundy memo to Rusk at the State Department. Taylor argued that the American short-term objectives should be to buy time for the South Vietnamese government and increase the morale of the people while holding North Vietnam in check. Long-term planning should continue to focus on a deliberate escalation of pressure against North Vietnam to begin after January 1st. He recommended a program consistent with Bundy's limited pressures, which he termed Course of Action A. The program would include the resumption of 34 Alpha operations and DeSoto destroyer patrols, U-2 surveillance flights over all of North Vietnam, and the initiation of airstrikes and South Vietnamese ground raids in Laos to counter North Vietnamese infiltration. Taylor argued that before progressing beyond these small pressures, the United States should raise the level of precautionary military readiness and introduce American air defense and marine infantry units into South Vietnam to protect against possible North Vietnamese retaliation. After these deployments, the United States would initiate a carefully orchestrated bombing attack on military targets in North Vietnam. In case the situation in South Vietnam became far more urgent than anticipated, Taylor developed an accelerated program of punitive action, Course of Action B, that would boost morale in South Vietnam and help hold the Saigon government together. Taylor's memorandum revealed the beginning of a significant shift in the administration's thinking about military action against the North. Previously, Lyndon Johnson's principal advisors viewed instability in the Saigon government as a reason to delay or forego action against North Vietnam. In the late summer of 1964, they began to consider airstrikes as a method for enhancing the stability of that government. When he first departed for Saigon, Taylor had promised President Johnson that he would return periodically to Washington for deliberations on Vietnam. Now Taylor's impending visit, combined with a grim assessment of the situation from General Westmoreland, spurred the chiefs into replying in detail to William Bundy's holding strategy. The chiefs' deliberations between August 26th and September 8th reflected deep divisions about what course of action to recommend for Vietnam. How they chose to reconcile those differences established a pattern of advice that would continue through July 1965. On August 26th, while General Wheeler was on leave, General LeMay, the senior chief present, chaired the JCS meeting. Although LeMay and his colleagues remained unable to agree, the Air Force Chief of Staff was determined to produce a paper that was generally consistent with his view of the military action needed in Vietnam. Using General Westmoreland's recent assessment of a distinct possibility of progressive deterioration in South Vietnam, LeMay urged the immediate adoption of Taylor's course of action B. LeMay emphasized the chief's common belief that the expansion of communism in Asia represented a serious threat to America's global political interests. In the aftermath of the Bay of Pigs, President Kennedy and Taylor had urged the chiefs to consider national political interests when deliberating on the use of force. As chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Taylor exhorted his staff to consider matters in broad political context through the eyes of the president. At the end of August 1964, the chiefs began to take that advice to heart. LeMay warned his colleagues that there was simply too much at stake to let their differences prevent military action against North Vietnam. Vietnam was a test case for defeating communist insurgencies. The United States could lose its position in Asia, and as it suffered a blow to its prestige and credibility with other nations, the communist movement would gain momentum worldwide. Communism, like Hitler after the Munich Agreement in 1938, would become emboldened and continue to expand until the United States and its closest allies in Europe became the last bastions of freedom in the world. Munich taught that the United States had to demonstrate an unyielding determination to protect non-communist governments from communist aggression. The chiefs did not question, as they had in the period from March to July 1964, the assumption that sharply limited military action against North Vietnam would reverse the deteriorating situation. Instead, they expressed a willingness to go along with Taylor's course of action B and hope for permission to pursue more resolute military measures in the future. Because they favored more immediate military action than the post-election application of pressure called for in course of action A, they stated the course of action B was more in accord with their thinking and ought to be approved immediately to prevent a complete collapse of the U.S. position in Southeast Asia. While accepting for the moment Taylor's recommendation that initial strikes against the North be sharply limited, the chiefs intimated that in the future they would recommend removing limitations on the use of force. They thought the course of action B would not be decisive and suggested that the United States might have to take more direct and forceful action, such as aerial mining of Haiphong Harbor, cross-border operations into Laos, hot pursuit into Cambodia, and U.S. aerial reconnaissance to attack Viet Cong bases outside of South Vietnam. The chiefs observed that these actions would probably not in themselves accomplish our objective of compelling North Vietnam to respond favorably, but advocated their adoption and implementation at once. Although they voiced skepticism about the effectiveness of limited military actions, the chiefs neglected to provide an estimate of what level of force would ultimately be required. Instead, they sought an open-ended commitment from the Secretary of Defense and the President to increase the level of military effort when, as they clearly predicted, the limited measures failed. The chief's inability to formulate a specific proposal or estimate of the situation left the initiative for planning with the proponents of graduated pressure. Far from registering dissatisfaction With the ambiguity of the chief's memo, however, McNamara seemed delighted with it. The JCS had given John McNaughton, McNamara's principal planner for Vietnam, the data he needed to continue developing courses of action. McNaughton was particularly pleased with an appendix to the memo that contained a revised list of 94 targets, along with ordnance and fuel requirements for hitting each target, aircraft availability and capability, and the number of sorties required. McNaughton lauded the hard work that had gone into the development of the target list and recommended that McNamara congratulate the chiefs on what seemed to McNaughton to be first-rate studies of the 94 targets. Thus, in August 1964, the JCS served more as technicians for planners in the Office of Secretary of Defense than as strategic thinkers and advisors in their own right. When McNaughton and William Bundy needed more information to develop their courses of action, they sent requests for data to the chiefs through the Secretary of Defense. McNaughton asked if sufficient stocks of ordnance and fuel existed to carry out airstrikes, and what effect bombing was likely to have on the capabilities of North Vietnam to sustain the insurgencies in Laos and South Vietnam. He also asked the chiefs whether North Vietnam might respond to bombing by escalating the war on the ground, using North Vietnamese regular forces. While the joint staff categorized targets and determined the numbers of bombs and gallons of fuel required to hit them, the JCS left the development of strategic options to attorneys McNaughton and Bundy. The JCS proved adept at providing technical information, but remained unable to respond to questions that had broad policy implications, the principal obstacle remaining the debate over the effectiveness of air power as a solution to the problem in Vietnam. On September 4, the chiefs met to draft answers to McNaughton's questions. General Johnson demanded that the chiefs remove a sentence in the memo asserting that air power offered the best chance of success in Vietnam and replace it with a sentence that described the proposed bombing of North Vietnam as merely one of the essential elements of a more comprehensive strategy. Johnson believed that Green and LeMay had misdiagnosed the nature of the war itself. They thought that North Vietnam caused the war, whereas Johnson asserted that the insurgency in the South was essentially indigenous. Johnson predicted that the war would continue at its present or increased intensity, even if North Vietnam were completely destroyed. LeMay urged the chiefs to press immediately for the destruction of the 94 North Vietnamese targets on their list, while Johnson insisted that any JCS recommendation state prominently that the war would ultimately be won or lost in South Vietnam and along its frontiers. The JCS agreed to take offensive action to destroy all Viet Cong and Pathet Lao supply depots, staging areas, and way stations on the Ho Chi Minh Trail complex to stop the infiltration of men and materiel into Laos and South Vietnam. However, Johnson believed that a series of ground offensives into Laos would interdict supplies most effectively, whereas LeMay believed that air attack would work best. General Green supported LeMay. Admiral McDonald, although sharing a degree of Johnson's skepticism about the effectiveness of aerial interdiction and concerned that military action alone would do little to enhance political stability in South Vietnam, remained equivocal. Johnson also feared that bombing North Vietnam would lead to an escalation of the war. He was consequently more willing than his Marine Corps and Air Force colleagues to accept limitations on a bombing campaign. He disputed LeMay's and Green's assessment that the hard knock would not provoke a response on the ground from North Vietnam and China, arguing that if more moderate pressures did not dissuade the Hanoi government from supporting the Viet Cong, it was illogical to conclude that more severe pressures would have any other effect than to increase and intensify the insurgency in the South. Escalation did not worry LeMay, who firmly believed that airstrikes against North Vietnam had every prospect for success and entailed far less risk than continuing on the present course. He thought that an air campaign against North Vietnam would actually lessen or remove altogether the possibility that U.S. ground forces